abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Monday, December 23rd, 2013, and this is our last program of the year. We'll resume on January 2nd, so you'll have plenty of time to catch up on any programs you may have missed, heaven forbid, over at TomWoodsRadio.com. And don't forget, the way you can warm my heart is by subscribing to the program on iTunes or Stitcher or your favorite podcatcher to make sure you don't miss any programs. And in fact, you're going to be very pleased that you tuned in today, because today we are joined by Jonathan Baylor, author of the forthcoming book, The Calorie Myth: How to Eat More, Exercise Less, Lose Weight, and Live Better. Jonathan Baylor is a preeminent nutrition and exercise expert and former personal trainer. He hosts a popular syndicated wellness radio show, blogs on the Huffington Post, and is also a senior program manager at Microsoft, and joins us today to talk about the calorie myth. Jonathan Baylor, thanks so much for being here.
Tom, absolutely a pleasure.
All right, this is a very provocative title for a book. And I'll tell you, I personally know people who have been trying or are trying to lose weight with a calorie kind of paradigm. And I have to say, although I don't share their view, I can understand the superficial plausibility of that approach. Because doesn't it seem sensible to say, well, there's some number out there, and if I take in more than I expend of that number, then I'm going to gain weight, and if I expend more than I take in, I'm going to lose it. What's the fundamental fallacy in that way of thinking?
You hit the nail on the head, Tom, when you said it's plausible, and that's why it's such a challenge to get rid of it. I like to call the calorie myth the flat earth theory of weight loss, because it's very plausible and it's intuitively correct that the earth is flat. Look out your window. It looks flat. And if it wasn't flat, wouldn't the bottom fall off? But once we understand science, we understand things like the laws of gravity, and we understand it becomes equally plausible to say that the earth isn't flat. And in fact, that is accurate. The same thing applies with the laws of physiology and biology and neurobiology and gastroenterology. You start to see that while it is plausible and it is in fact accurate to say that if you starve yourself, you will lose weight short term, when you understand how your body actually works, you start to see that the goal isn't short term weight loss. Everyone has lost weight short term. That's not the challenge. The challenge comes in when we look at the statistics and see that 95.4 of us gain all the weight back that we lost when we try to starve ourselves. And the reason for this is starvation actually works against biological law. It tries to fight against biological law. It's like trying to fight against gravity. You're going to lose eventually because you're trying to starve your body. Once we actually understand the laws of our body, much like once we understand the laws of geography, for example, we can actually work with our body rather than against it and start to achieve things that are seemingly impossible. For example, flight. Once you understand how gravity works, you can create an airplane that doesn't try to defy gravity. It works with gravity. Similarly, once you understand how your body actually works, you can do the seemingly impossible, and that's eat more and exercise less, change the system itself, and help your body burn fat long term rather than store fat long term.
All right, let's talk in a minute about why we should think in terms of types of calories rather than calories per se. But I want to sort of jump ahead here, because I'm curious about what you would think about, let's say, some agency of the U.S. government saying that there is so-and-so many calories you ought to be consuming per day. Is that a useless number then, if we're not discriminating between good and bad types of calories? Or is that still a useful baseline?
it's not a useful baseline. The number, it's not, I'm not saying, and the research isn't saying, that calories don't exist. Calories do exist. And if you continuously overconsume calories, you of course will gain weight. It's just not a relevant measure. It's not the primary measure. And in fact, when you use it as the primary measure, it is counterproductive, and for very simple reasons. You either think in terms of, just in terms of like priority in your brain, you either think in terms of calorie quantity, or you think in terms of food quality. If you think in terms of calorie quantity, you say things like, I should drink this can of Coke instead of eating this avocado, because the can of Coke has half as many calories as the avocado. Whereas if you think in terms of food quality, you would say, no, of course, I should eat the avocado, even though it contains more calories, because it will provide an abundance of healthy things for me. And you know what? Those calories, since they're coming from healthy sources, will just fill me up and cause me to eat fewer calories later in the day. So it really doesn't matter, because my body will work to automatically balance calories for me when it's healthy, just like it does for everything else. For example, blood sugar, blood pressure, or what about every vitamin and mineral? Do we need to consciously regulate the amount of vitamin C or vitamin E or vitamin D, A? What about phosphorus, magnesium, potassium, zinc, all of those things? Imagine if we actually needed to consciously regulate them. We don't. That doesn't mean our body can't break down. It doesn't mean the number of milligrams of vitamin C you eat in a day doesn't matter. It just means that we can't have to consciously regulate them. And if we just focus on eating high quality food, calorie quantity falls by the wayside and slim and healthy becomes incredibly simple.
Yeah, it's, you know, you say simple. I think the reason that people have fallen into what you call the calorie myth is because it's so simple, because it's a number. It's one number. And if I just add up all the constituent parts of my diet vis-a-vis this number, it'll give me some answer as to how I'm doing in terms of food intake. What should people be substituting for? Is there something they can substitute for that that's as simple as just this one figure?
Absolutely. If you cannot find what you're about to eat directly in nature, do not eat it. If you can, eat it whenever you're hungry and stop when you're full. The reason that works, Tom, and the reason I can say that with absolute certainty, is we have the most definitive proof you could ever ask for. Every, and this is not hyperbolic, every single person who ever lived in any culture anywhere on this planet did exactly what I just described prior to the current three generations and experienced at least 100,000 less percent incidence of diabetes, and the rates of obesity were sub 3%.
Are white potatoes an exception to that rule?
White potatoes will not make you fat if you eat all natural foods and have only ever eaten all natural foods. The key distinction with things like white potatoes, sweet potatoes, rice, etc., is we're comparing two different things when we have these nutritional arguments. One is, imagine a person who has only ever eaten things found in nature. Will that person get obese and diabetic from eating potatoes? No. That's one person. Now imagine another person. And imagine a person who has gone through the great nutritional depression. Someone who was told that Wonder Bread was good for them because it's low in fat. And someone who was told that Coca-Cola is not bad for them because it only has 140 calories. And because of this, they've eaten these toxic substances for decades, and they've yo-yo dieted, and they're experiencing metabolic dysregulation, which what that actually means is they have inflammation in their brain around their hypothalamus. They have a dysregulation of bacteria in their gut, and they have their hormones all out of whack. This individual has a broken metabolism, for lack of better terms. The types of foods someone who has a broken metabolism needs to eat to heal their metabolism is different from the types of foods someone who is already healthy can eat and avoid disease. Because one person's already good to go. The other person needs to go through a phase where they heal themselves. And then once they're in that healthy state, types of foods they could eat, such as potentially rice, white potatoes, sweet potatoes, become broader and they could eat those foods.
Now, how does this apply to dairy products? Are you generally pro-dairy? And if so, would you say that people need to be consuming raw milk, or at the very least whole milk, so that it's as close to the natural condition as possible? Or do you not come down on that side?
Scientifically, there is no such thing as an essential dairy product. I mean, obviously we don't need to eat dairy to be healthy. That said, blanketly saying all dairy products are toxic is inaccurate in my experience. The research shows that for dairy and for most other things, there's high quality sources and low quality sources. So we want to focus on dairy products that have the least hormones and obviously toxic things. And also dairy products, and this is a rule of thumb that we apply to all quote unquote food groups. What provides us the most of what we need? Essential amino acids, fatty acids, vitamins, minerals, and the least of what we don't. Say sugar, for example. So if you look at milk in an 8-ounce serving contains 8 grams of protein, something that's essential for life, and 12 grams of sugar, something that is not essential for life. Contrast that to a Greek yogurt. Greek yogurt would contain 24 grams of protein in a serving and about 7 grams of sugar. So you're looking at a dramatically different ratio of things we need versus things we don't need. So with dairy and everything else, you just want to choose the highest quality sources, or the sources with the least toxins and the most of what we need relative to the least of what we don't need.
Now, how does your general principle apply then to grains? A lot of people who are, I mean, in fact, you have in your book a foreword by Dr. William Davis, who's the author of Wheat Belly. And there have been a lot of people who've had a lot of success by trying to cut grains out of their diet. But couldn't we say that grains are naturally occurring? So what's the deal with grains?
Two things about the natural occurrence of grains. One, wheat is naturally occurring. Bread isn't. So anyone who wants to just eat a bowl of wheat is someone who is in a much different position than someone who's eating a bowl of Cheerios. So wheat is naturally occurring. Now, there's an additional challenge there. The wheat that we have in the United States, as anyone who's familiar with Dr. Davis's brilliant work will know, is chromosomally different than the wheat, let's say, of biblical times. So it is not the same thing. It's not even the same thing as what our grandparents ate. It is literally a different food. Genetically, it is a different substance. So when people say, well, what about grains? You have to look at two key things. One, if you eat the grain as it exists in nature, that is very distinct from the way most Americans consume grains. Two, even the grain as it exists in nature, you have to say, is that actually the grain, or is it a hybridized genetic GMO mutant? And if it is, then it's not a good call.
All right, let me ask you a sort of controversial question. Do you think somebody can really thrive on a vegan diet?
I think there are high quality and low quality versions of any sort of diet. Can someone thrive on a vegan diet? It would be hard. No civilization who ever lived were vegans, right? Like a vegan diet without intervention, for example, cannot provide you with vitamin B12. And if you don't eat vitamin B12, very, very bad things happen. That doesn't mean you can't be healthy and be a vegan. It just means you're going to have to try harder and be a bit more militant to be healthy as a vegan.
All right, let's shift gears for a moment here. Let's talk about the aspect of your book that involves exercising less. Now, some people love being in the gym all day and working out, but not everybody does. Not everybody enjoys it. Not everybody has the time. And with this calorie model, people think, well, I need to be on the treadmill for about 8 hours to make up for that half a piece of cheesecake I had or whatever, or even just to make up for the salad that I ate at lunch. What's wrong with that way of thinking?
Tom, once we understand the underlying biology, and that's really the key here, calorie math is math. It's not biology, and the human body doesn't follow algebraic laws. It follows biological laws. And if you look at biological laws and actual science versus algebraic theories, saying I'm going to walk on the treadmill for 4 hours because that burns whatever, 500 calories, and I ate 500 calories of cheesecake, so now I'm net neutral, is a bit like saying I just smoked a pack of cigarettes, so I'm going to go walk on the treadmill to cancel that out. Right? Or even for some listeners who may appreciate this, I sinned, So now I'm going to buy an indulgence and that will cancel out my sins. Like this, that's just not how it works. And that's the challenge and the fundamental problem with these calorie myths is it makes it seem like the body is this simple mathematical equation, which it's not. Coca-Cola is not bad for you because it contains 140 calories. 140 calories, like that data, if I just said you're eating 140 calories, that doesn't tell me anything about health outcomes. I have to know the source of the 140 calories. And we all get this because we know that, sure, calories give you energy. That's fine. But they don't provide you with essential nutrients and such that you need to heal your body. Coca-Cola is bad for you for reasons completely independent of its caloric intake. Therefore, if your approach to exercise is to cancel out calories, you may very well do that. But again, it's like trying to cancel out smoking by exercising. There's something totally non-caloric that we're missing completely, which is actually the cause of obesity and diabetes.
What do you think about the conventional approach that a lot of people take? I have to do some strength training and I have to do some cardio. And part of the reason I do the strength training is to look good. But the other part is that if I have big muscles, then I will burn calories faster. I can already kind of anticipate your answer, but again, is there any truth to that basic paradigm of cardio and strength training, or is the whole thing misplaced?
There's some truth, and there's some truth to all of this, Tom. That's why it's hard, because people like to think in terms of black and white, and like it's either about calories or it's not. It's difficult to communicate nuance, as you know, in our culture, and with a lot of these things, it's nuanced. So to the general calorie point, it's not that calories don't count. It's that you don't need to count calories. And those are very different statements, although they sound syntactically similar. When it comes to cardio and strength training, if you want to become better at doing cardio, aka you want to become a better triathlete, the best way to do that is to do cardio. If you want to become stronger, the best way to do that is strength training. You have to look at the individual's goals. If the individual's goal is to say, how can I heal the metabolic and neurological dysfunction which causes obesity and diabetes, we have to approach exercise in a unique way because we have a unique goal. And the unique way we approach exercise in that context where our goal isn't to become a better triathlete, it isn't to have bigger muscles, it's to cure a disease, we end up with much different approaches to exercise, much like if your goal was to become a better football player versus a better golfer, you would take a different approach to exercise.
Now, in your book, I mean, in a way, you are like the Voltaire of all this research. Who, during the Scientific Revolution, not everybody was reading The Great Scientist, but Voltaire would popularize it for the general public. You have basically synthesized an enormous amount of scientific research and packed it into this book. But my question is, though, a lot of what you're saying in this book runs totally counter to the conventional wisdom and to what we hear from official sources. For example, the food pyramid has been around for quite some time, urging us that we got to have, if we don't have our 8 daily servings of macaroni and cheese, we're not doing it right. Or the ideas of exercise that we hear, or these sorts of, or we got to drink however many glasses of milk. And you're really saying something that's rather different, or at least saying that the reality is more nuanced. How do you account for the disconnect between all this research that you're synthesizing on the one hand and the exact opposite message that's being conveyed to the public on the other?
Tom, I'll give you a very short answer and then a longer answer. The short answer is money. The longer answer is the quote-unquote traditional mainstream institutions. So let's put these mainstream institutions into two camps. One is a mainstream institution that has no financial interest in any given recommendation. The other is a group of mainstream institutions that does. Okay, an example of a mainstream institution that has no financial interest in any set of recommendations would be the Harvard Medical School or the Harvard School of Public Health. And look up Walter Willett online. He is the chair of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. Walter and his team have publicly denounced repeatedly the food guide pyramid. In fact, researchers at the Harvard Medical School have published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So we're talking about as mainstream and prestigious as you can get, that saturated fat has no relationship with the incidence of heart disease. This is published research by the Harvard Medical School in the Journal of the American Medical Association. No financial ties. What they're saying is completely in line with what I say in the book, because I'm just regurgitating what they're saying and making it simpler. And then let's go into the other arena. These are mainstream institutions that have financial ties to recommendations. For example, there is a United States Department of Agriculture. It's called the United States Department of Agriculture. It's not called the United States Department of Accurate Metabolic Science. Its interest is in promoting a profitable agriculture industry. If you need to sell what America produces, you cannot say any food is bad because you've eliminated an industry. You have to say anything's okay as long as you don't eat too much of it, and therefore you bias towards calories. Or think about it in terms of these companies that put little endorsement stickers, like little healthy hearts, on cereal boxes. If they're to say that grain isn't good for you, where do they get the hundreds of thousands of dollars they get from these companies to purchase their logo to put on their cereal boxes? And for exercise, again, are the exercise recommendations coming from boards that are purely academic in nature, or are they from boards that have relationships to institutions which are betting on frequent and long duration exercise? That explains the disconnect.
Okay, that just blew my mind, because I tend to be cynical about motives sometimes, whether it's a business or government, but that explanation about every time we criticize a particular kind of food or class of food, we destroy an industry, therefore we have to say everything's basically okay up to a point, and therefore that biases toward the calorie explanation. That just blew my mind. I never thought of that. That is absolutely brilliant. Now, I also want to ask you, I had this written down earlier and I forgot to get to it. On the subject of exercise, I want to get your thoughts on CrossFit. There's a lot of controversy about that. Some people say this is the best thing since sliced bread, and it's an exercise regimen that's it's not totally artificial, like you're a hamster on a wheel. It's doing things that, well, might have some kind of remote connection to things you might do in your real life, but it's extremely intense, and it might not be for everybody. Do you think it's for anybody?
CrossFit has amazingly positive aspects to it, and like most things in life, it can be used for good and it can be used for evil, right? Is the internet good or bad? Well, it kind of depends on what website you go to. So CrossFit, right. Some things that I really, really like about it. One, it embodies that intensity, not duration, aka quality, not quantity, is the arbiter of exercise success. And that is true, and that is non-controversial in the research. So CrossFit, with its focus on intensity, is brilliant. CrossFit, with its focus on, I'm going to call it, female empowerment, aka females train the exact same way that males train, and they use heavy resistance and intensity, is amazing, because the females in this culture have been lied to more than anyone else and have been subjugated more than anyone else in this concept of shrink yourself down and exercise more to shrink yourself and eat less to shrink yourself. Whereas CrossFit says, no, I want strong, powerful women who can contribute to this planet just like everyone else. And that's brilliant and awesome. And I love it. And I'm so happy to be part of a generation, right? My mother tells me that she was taught when she was growing up that if she started sweating, she was working too hard. Like, that was literally what she was taught. And I am so proud to be part of a generation that's saying, absolutely not. The females on this planet are just as capable and just as powerful as males, and they need to train the exact same way. So that is brilliant. With CrossFit and with anything else, we have to keep in mind that the most important thing, even above intensity, is safety. Because if you want to increase your health, hurting yourself does not assist in that goal. The ability to hurt yourself, if you do it improperly, is not unique to CrossFit, though. So we just have to keep in mind, with any exercise routine, safety and sustainability is priority number one. So just like jogging, or just like weight training, or even Zumba, or karate, or basketball could all contribute to injury, so can CrossFit. That's why it's really important that when you approach CrossFit or any other exercise routine, even above intensity, you've got to prioritize, do not hurt yourself. So if you do CrossFit, just make sure that your WOD or POD or whatever they call it has safety as priority number one.
You know, Jonathan, I've written quite a few books myself, and I was looking at your launch date for your book, December 31st, and I thought, boy, this publisher has no idea what they're doing, launching on December 31st. But that's brilliant, right before New Year's resolutions. Is that why you're doing it?
Yeah, it is quite common for publishers in the health industry to take what they believe will be their most influential title and just all throw them in the arena on the 31st to help contribute to that new year, new you. So there's quite a few health books being published at that time, and I'm very honored to have the opportunity.
Well, I want to urge people to check out your book, The Calorie Myth: Eat More, Exercise Less, Lose Weight, and Live Better. They can visit thecaloriemythbook.com. And, of course, get the book on Amazon, first entering Amazon through our widget at tomwoodsradio.com, of course. But what else? Is there anything else you want to promote? Because I'm glad to do it here.
Absolutely. Grabbing a copy of the book, especially before the 31st, is appreciated. And if you go to Amazon, that's much appreciated. You can also go to caloriemythbook.com. Again, that's caloriemythbook.com. And if you go there, you can also buy these pre-order bundles. And if you happen to buy a bundle because you want to give a book to maybe some friends or some family members who are struggling with their health or with weight loss, you also get a bunch of free bonus gifts for pre-ordering, because pre-ordering is especially helpful for our mission. And our mission is to make healthy healthy again. And what I mean by that, Tom, is truly, and this is non-debatable, as a culture, we are trying harder than ever to be healthy. And if you look at America compared to any other culture in the world, we're trying harder to be healthy and we're doing worse. That intuitively, it seems like there's something wrong there. You can't try harder and do worse. The reason that's happening is because we've been given the incorrect information. And we need to make healthy healthy again. And what I mean by that is the steps you take to increase your health to date very well may have made you less healthy. Think starvation. Think chronic exercise. Think eating artificial products rather than full fat whole foods. So we just want to get science up to speed with what the mainstream believes, because there's been vast, vast technological progress when it comes to food and exercise. But we continue to be told the same theories we were told 50 years ago, and that's wrong. And that's why we're trying harder and doing worse. And that's why we want to make healthy healthy again. So the easiest way to do that is to empower yourself with this proven science. And the easiest way to do that is to pick up a copy of The Calorie Myth.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. My apologies. I had in my show notes that there was a "the" in the URL. If it's just caloriemythbook.com, everybody listens to the program all the way through, so there'll be no harm done. I want people to go do that.
They both work, so
no
problem.
They both work. Oh, well, okay, so there is no problem. All right, well, Jonathan, I don't know. I wish every guest could be like you, really. I wish you all the best. You are a super-duper promoter of what you're doing. You're quick on your feet. You know the stuff. Fantastic. Best of luck to you, and thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Tom. Have a good one.
That'll do it for the program for today. A couple announcements. Those of you familiar with the program will know. Just a couple days left if you want to give the gift to your liberty-loving friends and relatives. That's libertyclassroom.com, where you can learn the history and economics they didn't teach you in courses you can listen to in your car. And through Christmas, we've got a special deal for listeners of this program, 35% off a year's subscription. And you can get that at libertyclassroom.com/secret. The offer is a secret. It's just for you guys. And then remember, you can help us keep the lights on and pay our bills here in our little Tom Woods Show office at no cost to yourself by entering Amazon when you're about to make your purchases through our little Amazon widget at tomwoodsradio.com. All right, check out all the episodes you may have missed at tomwoodsradio.com, and we'll see you again January 2nd. Merry Christmas, everybody. See you in the new year.
The Tom Woods Show.